Oh yes, Andy, your mates who aren't here. Look, you are not under arrest. Yet. You are helping the watch with their inquiries. That means you can use the privy if you're feeling brave. If you're feeling suicidal, use the canteen. But if you try to run off, I will hunt you down. She sniffed and added, like a dog. Understand? Can't I go and see how Nut is getting on? No. Kipper's still down there now. That's Constable Haddock to you. Everyone calls him Kipper. Maybe, but not when it's you talking to me. The sergeant twirled the favour around on the table in an absent-minded way. Has Mr. Nut got any next of kin? That means relatives. I know what it means. He talks about people in Uberwald. That's all I know, Trev lied instinctively. Saying that someone had spent his youth chained to an anvil was not going to help here. He gets on all right with the other guys in the vats. How come he's in there? We never ask. There's usually some bad story. Anyone ever ask you? He stared at her. That was coppers for you. They came over all friendly, and just when you dropped your guard, they stuck a pickaxe in your brain. Was that an official copper question, or were you just being nosy? Coppers are never nosy, Mr. Likely. However, sometimes we ask tangential questions. So it wasn't official? Not really. Then shove it where the sun does not shine. Sergeant Angua smiled a copper's smile. You've got no card in your hand that you dare play, and you come out with something like that. From Andy, yes, I'd expect it, but Kipper says you're smart. How smart does someone have to be as stupid as you? There was a tentative knock at the door, and then a watchman put his head around it. Someone was shouting in the background in a large, authoritative voice. I mean, you deal with this sort of thing all the time, don't you? For heaven's sake, it's not that hard. Yes, Nobby.
We've got a bit of a situation, Sarge. That stiff that went to Lady Sibyl, Dr. Lawn's here, and he says the man's got up and gone home.
Did they get an Igor to look at him?
Yeah, sort of, eh?
The watchman was elbowed out of the way by an expansive man in a long green rubber robe who was clearly trying to balance angry and friendly at the same time. He was tailed by Constable Haddock, who was clearly trying to mollify him and definitely failing.
"Look, we try to help, all right," said Dr. Lorne. "You people say you've got a murder case, and I'll pull old Igor off his slab and hang the overtime. But you tell Sam Vimes from me that I'd like him to send his boys down when they're not busy for a bit of first-aid tuition, to wit, the difference between dead and sleeping. It's a fine line sometimes, but it's generally possible to spot the clues. The profession has always tended to consider walking about to be among the more reliable, although in this city we've learned to look on that as just a very good start. But when we pulled back the sheet, he sat up and asked Igor if he had a sandwich, which is generally conclusive. Apart from a fever, he was fine. Strong heartbeat, which suggests he's got one. Not a scratch on him, but he could certainly do with a good dinner. He must have been hungry because he ate the sandwich Igor made for him. On the subject of dinners, frankly, I could do with mine.
You let him go? Said Sergeant Angua, horrified.
Of course! I can't keep a man in hospital for being inconveniently alive.
She turned to Constable Haddock.
And you let him go, Kipper?
It looked like a case of doctor's orders, Sarge, said Haddock, giving Trev a wretched look.
He was covered in blood. He was really messed up, Trev exploded.
A prank, then, Angua tried.
"I'd have sworn there wasn't an heartbeat, Sergeant," Haddock volunteered. "Maybe he's one of those monks from the Hub that do the hocus-pocus stuff."
"Then someone has been wasting watch time," said Angua, glaring at Trev. He spotted that one for the desperate throw it was.
"What would be in it for me?" he said. "Do you think I want to be here?"
Constable Haddock cleared his throat.
"It's match night, Sarge. The desk is even, and there are supporters roaming around all over the place, and someone's been feeding them a lot of rumours. We're stretched, that's all I'm saying. We've had a couple of big shouts already, and he did walk away after all.
Not a problem for me, said the doctor. Came in horizontal, went out upright. It's the preferred way. But I've got to get back, Sergeant. We're going to have a busy night too.
The sergeant looked for someone to shout at, and there was Trev.
You, Trev Likely, this one's down to you. Go and find your chum.
and if there's any more trouble, there'll be... trouble. Is that clear? Twice, Sarge. He couldn't resist it. He just couldn't. Not even with the cold sweat rolling down his spine. But he felt light. Uplifted. Released. But some people just can't respect an epiphany when you're having one. It's not a cop skill. It's Sergeant to you, likely. Here. Trev managed to catch the favour as it was skimmed across the room. Thanks, Sarge. Get out. He got out, and was half expecting the shadowy shape that stepped up to him when he was clear of the building. There was a faint odour in the grey air. Well, at least it wasn't Andy. He could do without Andy right now. Yes, Carter, he said to Fogg.
How did you know it was me?
Trev sighed. I guessed. He started to walk fast.
And you'll want to know what you said.
Don't worry, it's sorted.
Sorted? How?
Carter, always a bit overweight, had to scurry to keep up. Not going to tell you. Oh, the joy of the moment.
But can I tell him we're in the clear?
It's all sorted. Done and dusted. I blew it out. It's fixed. All gone away. It never happened.
Are you sure?
Said Carter.
He was pretty busted up.
Hey, what can I tell you? Trev flung out his arms and twirled a pirouette. I'm Trev Lightly.
Well, that's firm then. Hey, I bet Andy'll let you back in the posse now. That'd be great, eh?
Do you know what Nut thought the posse was called, Carter?
No, what?
Trev told him.
Well, that's...
Carter began, but Trev interrupted.
It's funny, Carter. It's funny and sort of sad and hopeless. It really is.
Trev stopped walking so abruptly that Carter collided with him.
And here's a tip. Carter the Farter isn't going to take you anywhere, and that goes for the Fartmeister too. Trust me.
But everybody calls me Carter the Farter,
the Fartmeister wailed.
Punch the next one who does. See a doctor. Cut down on carbohydrates. Keep out of confined spaces. Use aftershave, said Trev, speeding up again.
Where are you going, Trev?
I'm getting out of the shove, Trev called over his shoulder.
Carter looked around desperately.
What shove?
Haven't you heard? It's all shove.
Trev wondered if he glowed as he trotted through the fog. Things were going to be different. As soon as Smeems got in, he'd go and see him about a better job or something. A figure appeared out of the mist ahead of him. This was something of an achievement, since the figure was a head shorter than him.
Mr. Likely, it said.
Who's asking? Said Trev, and added, what's asking?
The figure sighed.
I understand that you are a friend of the gentleman recently admitted to the hospital, it said.
What's that to you?
Quite a lot, said the figure. May I ask if you know very much about the gentleman?
I don't have to talk to you, said Trev. Everything's been fixed, okay?
Would that this was the case, said the figure. I have to talk to you. My name is Igor.
You know, I had a feeling about that. Are you the one who made the sandwich for Nut? Asked Trev.
Yes. Tuna, spaghetti and jam, with sprinkles. My signature dish. Do you know anything about his background?
Not a thing, mister.
Really?
Look, in the vats, you stir up tallow, not the past, OK? You just don't, right? I know he's had some bad times, and that's all I'm telling you.
I thought so, said Igor. I believe he comes from Oberwelt. Some strange and dangerous things come from Oberwelt.
This might sound a stupid question, but do you come from Oberwelt by any chance? Said Trev.
Since you ask, yes, said Igor.
Trev hesitated. You saw Igors around occasionally. The only thing most people knew was that they could stitch you up even better than the watch, and did strange things in cellars, and only tended to come out much when there were thunderstorms.
I think your friend may be very dangerous, said Igor.
Trev tried to picture Nut as dangerous. It was quite hard until you remembered a throw that knocked down a whole goalpost half a street away. He wished he didn't.
Why should I listen to you? How do I know you are not dangerous? He said.
Oh, I am, said Igor. Believe me, and Oberwelt contains things that I would not want to meet.
I am not going to listen to you, said Trev, and you are pretty hard to understand in any case.
Is he subject to strange moods? Igor ploughed on. Does he get into a rage? Do you know anything about his eating habits?
Yeah, he likes apple pies, said Trev.
What are you on about?
I can see you are great friends, said Igor. I am sorry that I have trespassed on your time.
Trespassed, hanging in the air, considerably added to the water drops hanging in the fog.
I will give you some advice. When you need me, just scream. I regret that you will find it very easy to scream.
The figure turned and instantly vanished into the mist. And Igor's moved about oddly, Trev remembered, and you never saw one at a football game. He noticed that last thought go past. What did he try to tell himself? That someone who did not watch football was not a real person? He couldn't think of a proper answer. He was amazed that he even asked the question. Things were changing. Glenda arrived in the night kitchen with Juliet sworn to silence, and beneficently gave Mildred and Mrs. Hedges the rest of the night off. That suited them both very well, as it always does, and a little favour had been done there that she could call upon when necessary. She took her coat off and rolled up her sleeves. She felt at home in the night kitchen, in charge, in control. Behind black iron ranges, she could defy the world. "All right," she said to the subdued Juliet. "We weren't there today. Today did not happen. You were here helping me clean the ovens. I'll see you get some overtime so your dad won't suspect. Okay? Have you got that?"
"Yes, Glenda."
"And while we're here, we'll make a start on the pies for tomorrow night. It'll be nice to get ahead of ourselves, right?" Juliet said nothing. "Say yes, Glenda," Glenda prompted.
"Yes, Glenda."
"Go and chop some pork, then. Being busy takes your mind off things. That's what I always say."
"Yes, Glenda, that's what you always say," said Juliet.
An inflection caught Glenda's ear and worried her a little. "Do I always say that? When?"
"Every day when you come in and put your apron on, Glenda."
"Mother used to say that," said Glenda, and tried to shake the thought out of her head. And she was right, of course. Hard work never hurt anybody. And she tried to unthink the treacherous thought, except her. Pies, she thought. You can rely on pies. Pies don't give you grief.
"I think that Trev likes me," Juliet muttered. "He don't give me funny looks like the other boys. He looks like a little puppy."
"You want to watch out for that look, my girl."
"I think I love him, Glendy."
Wild boar, thought Glenda, and apricots. There's some left in the cool room. And we've got mutton pies with a choice of tracklements, always popular. So, pork pies, I think, and there's some decent oysters in the pump room, so they'll do for the wet pie. I'll do sea pie, and the anchovies look good, so there's always room for a stargazy or two, even though I feel sorry for the little fishes, but right now I'll bake some blind pastries so that... What did you say?
"I love him."
"You can't."
"He saved my life."
"That's no basis for a relationship. A polite thank you would have sufficed."
"I've got a feeling about him."
"That's just silly."
"Well, silly's not bad, is it?"
"Now you listen to me, young..." "Oh, hello, Mr. Otomy."
It is in the way of the Otomys all around the worlds to look as if they have been built out of the worst parts of two men and to be annoyingly hushen-footed on thick red rubber soles, all the better to peep and pry. And they always assume that a free cup of tea is theirs by right.
"What a day, miss, what a day! Were you at the match?" he inquired, glancing from Glenda to Juliet. "Been cleaning the ovens," said Glenda briskly.
"Yeah, today didn't happen," Juliet added and giggled.
Glenda hated giggling. Otomy looked around slowly and without embarrassment, noting the absence of dirt, discarded gloves, cloths.
"And we've only just finished getting everything all neat and tidy," Glenda snarled. "Would you like a cup of tea, Mr. Otomy? Then you can tell us all about the game."
It has been said that crowds are stupid, but mostly they are simply confused, since, as an eyewitness, the average person is as reliable as a meringue life jacket. It became obvious, as Otomy went on, that nobody had any clear idea about anything other than that some bloke threw a goal from halfway down the street, and even then only maybe.
"But funny thing," Otomy went on, as Glenda metaphorically let out a breath, "while we was in the shove, I could have sworn I saw your lovely assistant here chatting to a lad in a dimmer strip."
"No law against that," Glenda said. "Anyway, she was here, cleaning the ovens." It was clumsy, but she hated people like him who lived for the exercise of third-hand authority and loved every little bit of power they could grab. He'd seen more than he'd told her, that was certain, and wanted her to wriggle. And out of the corner of her mind, she could feel him looking at their coats. Their wet coats.
"I thought you didn't go to the football, Mr. Ottomy."
"Ah, well, there you have it. The pointies wanted to go and watch a game, and me and Mr. Nobbs had to go with them in case they got breathed on by ordinary people. Blimey, you wouldn't believe it. Tutting and complaining and taking notes like they owned the street. They're up to something, you mark my words."
Glenda didn't like the word pointies, although it was a good description. Coming from Ottomy, though, it was an invitation to greasy conspiracy. But however you baked it, wizards were nobs, people who mattered, the movers and the shakers. And when people like that got interested in the doings of people who by definition did not matter, little people were about to be shaken and shook.
"Vetinari doesn't like football," she said.
"Well, of course, they're all in it together," said Ottomy, tapping his nose.
This caused a small lump of dried matter to shoot from his other nostril into his tea. Glenda had a brief struggle with her conscience of whether to point this out, but won.
"I thought you should know this on account of how people up in the Sisters look up to you," said Ottomy. "I remember your mum. She was a saint, that woman. Always had a helping hand for everyone."
"Yes, and didn't they grab," said Glenda to herself. She was lucky to die with all her fingers. Ottomy drained his mug and plonked it on the table with a sigh.
"Can't stand around here all day, eh?"
"Yes, I'm sure you've got lots of other places to stand."
Ottomy paused at the entrance arch and turned to grin at Juliet.
"A girl, the spitting image of you, I'd swear it, with a dimmer boy, amazing. You must have one of those double gangers. Well, it'll have to remain a mystery, as the man said when he found something that would have to remain a mystery. Toodaloo."
He stopped dead rather than walk into the silvery knife that Glenda was holding in a not totally threatening way quite close to his throat. She had the satisfaction of seeing his Adam's apple pop back up and down again like a sick yo-yo.
"Sorry about that," she said, lowering it. "I've always got a knife in my hand these days. We've been doing the pork. Very much like human flesh pork, or so they say."
She put her spare hand across his shoulders and said,
"Probably not a good idea, spreading silly rumours, Mr. Ottomy. You know how people can be so funny about that sort of thing. Nice of you to drop by, and if you happen to be going past tomorrow, I'll see that you get a pie. Do excuse us. I have a lot of chopping up to do."
He left at speed. Glenda, her heart pounding, looked at Juliet. Her mouth made a perfect O.
"What? What? I thought you was going to stab him."
"I just happened to be holding a knife. You are holding a knife. We hold knives. This is a kitchen."
"Do you think he's going to tell?"
"He doesn't really know anything."
8 inches, she thought. That's as big as you can make a pie without a dish. How many pies could I make out of a weasel like Ottomy? The big mincer would make it easy. Rib cages and skulls must be a problem, though. Probably better on the whole to stick to pork. But the thought blazed away at the back of her mind, never to become action, but unfamiliar, exciting, and oddly liberating. What were the wizards doing at the game? Making notes about what? A puzzle to think about. In the meantime, they were in a world of pies. Juliet could work quite well at repetitive jobs when she put her mind to it, and she had a meticulousness often found in people who were not very clever. Occasionally she sniffed. Not a good thing when you were making a pie filling. She was probably thinking about Trev and pasting him in her beautiful and not very overcrowded head into one of those glittery dreams sold by Bubble and other junk, where all you had to do to be famous was just be yourself. While Glenda had always known what she wanted. She worked long, poorly paid hours to get it, and here it was, her own kitchen and power, more or less, over pies. A moment ago you were daydreaming of turning a man into pies. "Why are you so angry all the time? What went wrong?" "I'll tell you what went wrong. When you got there, there was no there there. You wanted to see Quirm from an open carriage while a nice young man drank champagne out of your slipper, but you never did, because they were a funny lot in Quirm, and you couldn't trust the water. And how did that champagne thing work, anyway? Didn't it drip out? What would happen if your toe trouble played up again? So you never did. Never will.
"'I never said Trev's a bad lad,' she said aloud. "'Not a gentleman. Needs a slap to teach him manners, and he takes life a good deal too easily. But he could make something of himself if he had reason to put his mind to it.' Juliet did not seem to be listening, but you never could tell. "'It's just the football. You're on different sides. It won't work,' Glenda finished. "'Supposing I went and supported the Dimmers?' A day ago that would have sounded like some kind of sacrilege. Now it just presented a huge problem. For a start, your dad wouldn't speak to you ever again, or your brothers. They don't know much, anyway, except to ask when their grub is going to be ready. Do you know, today was the first time I ever saw the ball up close. And you know what? It weren't worth it. Hey, and they're going to have a fashion show on at Shatter tomorrow. Why don't we go?
Never heard of it, Glenda snorted.
It's a dwarf store.
That sounds right. I can't imagine humans naming anything like that. You'd be hostage to the first misprint.
We could go. Might be fun.
Juliet waved a tattered copy of Bubble.
And the new micromails are going to be really good and soft. And don't chafe, it says here. Plus, all helmets are making a return after too long in... obscurity. Where's that? And there's this mat in... a tomorrow.
Yes, but we're not the kind of women who go to fashion shows, Jules.
You're not. Why am I not?
Well, because... Well, I wouldn't know what to wear. Glenda was getting desperate now.
That's why you should go to fashion shows, said Juliet smugly.
Glenda opened her mouth to snap a reply and thought, It's not about boys, and it's not about football. It's safe.
All right. I suppose it might be fun. Look, we've done a woman's job this evening. I'll take you home now and do my chores and come back. Your dad might be worrying.
He'll be in the pub, said Juliet accurately.
Well, he would be worrying if he wasn't, said Glenda. She wanted some time to herself with her feet up. It hadn't just been a long day. It had been a long and deep one as well. She needed some time for things to settle. And we'll take a chair. How about that?
They're very expensive.
Well, you're only young once. That's what I say.
I never heard you say that before.
Several troll chairs were waiting outside the university. They were expensive at 5 pence for the ride, but the seats in panniers around the carrier's neck were much more comfy than the slats on the buses. Of course, it was posh, and curtains twitched and lips pursed. That was the strange thing about the street. If you were born there, people didn't like it if you started not to fit in. Granny had called it getting ideas above your station. It was letting the side up. She opened Juliet's door for her because the girl always fumbled with the lock and watched it shut. Only then did she open her own front door, which was as patched and peeling as the other one. She'd hardly taken her coat off when there was a hammering on the weather-beaten woodwork. She flung it open to find Mr. Stollop, Juliet's father, one fist still raised and a little cloud of powdered paint flecks settling all around him.
"Heard you coming, Glendy," he said. "What's this all about?"
His other huge hand rose, holding a crisp, off-white envelope. You didn't see many of these in Dolly Sisters.
"It's called a letter," said Glenda.
The man held it out imploringly, and now she noticed the large letter V on the dreaded government stamp, guaranteed to spread fear and despondency among those with taxes yet to pay.
"It's his lordship writing to me," said Mr. Stollop in distress. "Why do you want to go and write to me? I haven't done nothing."
"Have you thought about opening it?" said Glenda. "That's generally how we find out what's in letters."
There was another of those imploring looks. In Dolly Sisters, reading and writing was soft indoor work that was best left to the women. Real work required broad backs, strong arms and calloused hands. Mr. Stollop absolutely fitted the bill. He was captain of the Dollies and in one match had bitten an ear off 3 men. She sighed and took the letter from a hand which, she noticed, was slightly trembling, and slit it open with her thumbnail.
"It says here, Mr. Stollop," she said, and the man winced. "Yes, that would be you," Glenda added.
"Is there anything about taxes or anything?"
he said. "Not that I can see. He writes that I would greatly appreciate your company at a dinner I am proposing to hold at Unseen University at 8 o'clock Wednesday evening to discuss the future of the famous game Foot the Ball. I will be pleased to welcome you as the captain of the Dolly Sisters team."
"Why has he picked on me?"
Stollop demanded.
"He says," said Glenda, "because you're the captain."
"Yeah, but why me?"
"Maybe he's invited all the team captains," Glenda volunteered. "You could send a lad round with a white scarf and check, couldn't you?"
"Yeah, but supposing it's just me,"
said Stollop again, determined to plumb the horror to its depths. Glenda had a bright idea.
"Well then, Mr. Stollop, it would look like the captain of the Dolly Sisters is the only one important enough to discuss the future of football with the ruler himself."
Stollop didn't square his shoulders because he wore them permanently squared, but with a muscular nudge he managed to achieve the effect of cubed.
"Ha! He's got that one right!" he roared.
Glenda sighed inwardly. The man was strong, but his muscles were melting into fat. She knew his knees hurt. She knew he got out of breath rather quickly these days, and in the presence of something he couldn't bully, punch or kick, Mr. Stollop was entirely at a loss. Down by his sides, his hands flexed and unflexed themselves as they tried to do his thinking for him.
"What's this all about?"
"I don't know, Mr. Stollop." He shifted his weight.
Would it be about that Dimmer boy that got himself hurt today, d'ye think?"
"Could be anyone," thought Glenda, as cold dread blossomed. "It's not as though it doesn't happen every week. It doesn't have to be either of them." "It will be, of course. I know it, but I don't know it. Can't possibly know it. And if I repeat that long enough, it might all never have happened." "Got himself hurt," thought Glenda in the roar of panic. "That quite likely means he happened to be standing in the wrong place, in the wrong strip, which is tantamount to a self-inflicted wound. He got himself killed."
"My lads came in and said it was out in the street. That's what they just heard. He got killed. That's what they heard."
"They didn't see anything."
"That's right, they didn't see a thing."
"But they were doing a lot of listening."
That one went over Stollop's head without even bothering to climb.
"And it was a Dimmer boy."
"Yeah,"
he said.
"They heard he died, but you know how those Dimwell buggers lie."
"Where are your boys now?"
For a moment, the old man's eyes blazed.
"They're stopping indoors, or I'll thrash 'em. You get some nasty gangs out when something like that's been happening."
"One less now, then," said Glenda.
Stollop's face was painted in pigments of misery and dread.
"They're not bad boys, you know, not at heart. People pick on 'em."
"Yes, down at the watch house," she said to herself, "where people say, 'That's them, the big ones, I'd know them anywhere.'" She left him, shaking his head, and ran down the road. The troll would never expect to get a fare up here, and there was no sense in hanging around and getting covered in paint. She might just about be able to catch up with it on its way downtown. After a minute or two, she realised that someone was following her, chasing her in the gloom. If only she'd remembered to bring the knife. She stepped into a patch of deeper shadow and, as the knife-wielding maniac drew level, stepped out and shouted, "Stop following me!" Juliet gave a little scream.
"They've got Triv," she sobbed as Glenda held her. "I know they have."
"Don't be silly," said Glenda. "There's fighting all the time after a big match. No sense in getting too worried."
"So why were you running?"
said Juliet sharply. And there was no answer to that. The Bledlow nodded him through the staff door with a grunt, and he headed straight away for the vats. A couple of the lads were dribbling in their meticulous and very slow way, but there was no sign of Nut until Trev risked his sanity and nasal passages by checking the communal sleeping area, where he found Nut sleeping on his bedroll, clutching his stomach. It was an extremely large stomach. Given the usual neat shape of Nut, it made him look a little like a snake that had swallowed an extremely large goat. The curious face of the Igor and his worried voice came back to him. He looked down beside the bedroll and saw a small piece of pie crust and some crumbs. It smelled like a very good pie. In fact, he could think of only one person who could ever make a pie quite so beguiling. Whatever it was that had been filling Trev, the invisible illumination that had made him almost dance here from the watch house drained out through his feet. He headed through the stone corridors to the night kitchen. Any optimism he might have retained was dashed, one hope at a time, by the trail of pie crumbs. But the illumination rose again as he saw Juliet and, oh yes, Glenda, standing in what was left of the night kitchen, which was a mess of torn open cupboards and pieces of pie crust.
"Oh, Mr. Trevor Likely," said Glenda, folding her arms. "Just one question. Who ate all the pies?"
The illumination swelled until it filled Trev with a kind of silvery light. It had been 3 nights since he had slept in an actual bed,